Hello and welcome to ASI Cast episode 179. I'm Richard Marks, ASI's Research Director, and joining me today is Jason Brownlee of Colortext. So welcome, Jason.
Good morning, Richard. It's great to be with you. Thank you for the invite.
Now, Jason is going to be speaking at our radio and audio conference coming up on the 8th of November in Venice. So we thought it'd be interesting to get a preview what he's going to be talking about, but also perhaps talk a bit more about the wider context in terms of what we're going to actually be talking about. So I think the first thing that'd be interesting to talk about is I know, our paths have crossed many times in the past. You've been active in radio for quite a while now. How did you start out in the radio industry, and what's your main area of activity nowadays?
Well, you're right. We have been crossing paths for quite a while, Richard. My career in media began shortly after graduation, and I was working setting classified ads in the Warrington Guardian, which was owned by Eddie Shah's group at the time. So not many people remember Eddie Shah, but he introduced computerized typesetting and printing processes into the newspaper industry for the first time, and there was a huge amount of industrial unrest around that process. Anyway, he owned our local newspaper, and I got my first taste of media there. And after finishing a second degree, I got onto a graduate training scheme that doesn't seem to happen that often these days, run by EMAP. And I began work as a researcher at Piccadilly Radio in Manchester in 1995. So that's where my radio life began, which is nearly 30 years now. So I began there, and after a stint in Manchester, I then got a dream job, which was head of research at Kiss FM, which for me was just about the coolest place to work in the universe. It was London's premier youth station and dance music station with a legendary reputation for coolness. So it was a huge thrill to work there, and then eventually head of insight for EMAP. And that included all the magazines, particularly the music magazines, which I had a passion for. And that's kind of where my career started.
And with Colortext, what's your main area of activity now? Because you're still very much connected to the radio industry, but much more, I think, on the insight front.
Yeah, very much so. Colortext is primarily an advertising effectiveness and audience insight business. We've been going now since 2009, and we work with a whole range of clients, all the big corporate names, not just in the UK but overseas as well, and not just in audio. But in the UK, we'll work with a lot of the familiar audio names, have a very strong relationship with Radio Centre, and I enjoy that particularly because of the way the Radio Centre is funded. The Radio Centre can engage in questions and problems at a strategic macro level that individual radio operators probably find hard to justify funding on their own. So the UK industry has a fantastic advantage in that respect in audio research. But I work in TV a lot, and I've also, in the past, launched online brands, particularly in the health and supplements business, and that's given me an insight into the relationship between offline media and online and performance marketing, and how the two can and should work together. So, I do a lot of work in all of those areas these days, Richard.
It's winding out in terms of the wider context for our event in Venice. What would you say are the main challenges that the radio industry faces? Firstly, I'll come on to advertising in a moment, but just generally in terms of attracting and retaining audiences nowadays.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's probably the right way to break it down as well. I think for radio, I think having a good theory of why radio works even now, I think is really important. I wrote an article a long time ago about why isn't radio dead yet? And that kind of coincided with the 25th anniversary of the launch of the iPod. Now, the iPod promised a future of personalized music consumption, where you didn't have to care about anybody else's choices or preferences. You could have exactly what you wanted to listen to. And we know that the iPod went on to knock the ornaments off the mantelpiece for many different industries, not least the music business. And yet it didn't hurt radio. Radio is as strong as it's ever been, if not stronger. And I think we need a theory for why that is. My own personal thoughts about what that theory is, and that theory is important, because if you don't understand why you're still standing and you try changing things, you may change the wrong things, and we don't want to do that. But I would say that, first of all, listening occasions for audio still matter. Radio is primarily a secondary medium. It's consumed as an accompaniment to other primary activities, and it fits in really well with people's busy lifestyles. And it's a mood enhancer at those occasions. If I have a concern about the future, one that springs to mind is full self-driving capability in vehicles. We know that on public transport, I'm sure people still listen to the radio and very often listen to music and audio generally, but social media has gobbled up a lot of the media time on public transport, and that's basically wiped out the newspaper business in many respects. I do worry about what the plan is for full self-driving, when people can continue browsing on social without having to watch the road. So a key primary activity for radio is going to be slowly disappearing. So I do worry about what that might mean.
Yeah, you highlight a really interesting point there, which is that, I think the enduring strength of radio is its ability to accompany other tasks, tasks where you are using your eyes, you're doing your housework, you're driving your car, as you say, but what your ears want to be absorbing information. And as you say, if people don't have to concentrate on driving their cars, then they're going to be doom scrolling probably in the back of the car.
Yeah, I completely agree. So that is one of the things that has made radio a continual success at the time that the iPod has broken everything else for for established media consumption patterns. I would also say something to watch out for the future is family listening is important. Children often become habituated to media channels through joint listening or joint consumption occasions with their parents. Whether we think as an industry hard enough about family listening as an advertiser target audience, is one question. But I would certainly say, from a future-proofing programming imperative, thinking about family listening dynamics is probably going to be important to make sure your future audience is there 10 years from now. So I would throw that into the ring as something to think about.
Yeah, really interesting. I guess the generational thing in music is something I've always been particularly interested in, because when I was young, my parents listened to completely different music to me. It was pre and post rock and roll. Whereas nowadays, I think there is. If you listen to some of the younger artists around, quite clearly they've been influenced by their parents' record collections, and the ability to target cross-generationally, I think it's going to be interesting going forward, particularly as you say around things like breakfast and so on, in terms of who chooses the station that's on and the degree of agreement around it. But specifically when it comes to ad spend, we've talked about attracting audiences, but what are the barriers that, you work very closely with the radio centre, what are the barriers that they see? What are the arguments that they need to be making to persuade advertisers that they should be maintaining and growing their share of ad spend?
I I think a lot of what dictates, this is going to sound quite odd. I think a lot of what kind of really dictates where ad spend goes isn't fully vocalized. I don't think it's wholly conscious. I think there's a lot of stuff that moves the needle on planning decisions and where budget gets allocated that is kind of like below the surface. I mean, I'll give you one example. I mean, I think radio faces two key strategic issues about improving its share of all ad revenue. And I would argue that, I would say that physics is in favor of radio on this, because if you look at radio's share of media time, it's kind of around the 20% mark, something like that. But here in the UK, we're looking at like a 5% share of ad budget. Now, what I would say is that I don't think it's the laws of physics that's holding radio's share of ad spend back. I think there are other factors and choices that people are making, which are probably deep cultural patterns and habits in the media industry, which we still don't fully understand, and we haven't overcome them yet. I think that where I would begin is, first of all, every offline media channel has got a problem when it comes to connecting offline media exposure with online engagement with brands and online browsing activity related to sales and all the stuff that, consumer brands care about. That kind of leads to an attribution culture within a lot of modern media planning, performance channel marketing primarily. And the rules of that game are not dictated by the legacy media channels. They've been dictated by the newer platforms like Meta and Google, for instance. And one of the issues that we've discovered with work with the Radio Centre, and it's again, it's the physics. Let's just get back to the physics of things. It's very hard for radio to play by the rules set by the performance channels, the performance marketing channels, because they are looking at ad response periods within the minutes. Ad goes out, market response signal comes back, and then you attribute the outcome that the brand was looking for, or the campaign is targeted on, to the ad that happened to be out at the time that that market signal pinged off. Now, with radio, as we just discussed earlier, it's a secondary medium that's accompanying a lot of other primary tasks. The physical availability of radio listeners to respond within those kind of attribution periods is not happening. Because, with the best will in the world, as much as I love radio, nobody is veering their car off the road into the nearest lay-by to respond to an ad that they just heard on the radio station. So there is a response to radio advertising, but it doesn't have the immediacy that the attribution models are looking for. There is a delayed response. So there's a structural problem already built into the way radio is being appraised and evaluated. So if we're trying to play the attribution game as an audio industry, strategically, we're not even at the same starting line as the performance marketing platforms. We're 6 feet behind that line when the race starts. So you have to take that into account. It's not an insuperable challenge, but you are not going to double radio share from 5% to 10% if you continue to play by those rules. So there's one thing that I think about a lot. I would say the second thing is those market response signals are incredibly seductive. Now, my daughter has started working in the media industry now, and she's working for one of the major agencies, and she's been booking pay-per-click campaigns. And when those campaigns go live, you're immediately getting market response signals on, what the ad response is. Do you know what? It feels very exciting when that starts. There is a dopamine hit built into that whole way of allowing media planners to manage their clients' business. And That kind of data presence on the planner's desktop is something that radio, and I would argue to the same, to a similar degree, TV just hasn't emulated yet. When those planners are kicking off those campaigns, and if you speak to them, it feels as good as having a new Instagram message going out and getting loads of likes. We're nowhere, we're not even on the same ballpark with that kind of lived data experience for audio. Again, massive strategic impediment to improving growth in a world where the rules of ad spend are dictated by these new platforms. We need to be smarter about how we play this game.
I'm definitely going to quote you on that analogy between sales outcome and Facebook likes. I think that does get to a lot of the center of a lot of issues. You talked about the work you've been doing with Radio Center. There's a couple of recent projects. We'll come on to what you're talking about in Venice in a moment. But there's a couple of recent projects you were involved in. One called Big Audio Data Mine. And the other, which I think Donna Burns from Radio Centre is going to be presenting in Venice, called the Performance Multiplier. What's the main objective of those two projects, briefly?
Well, dealing with big, turning to Big Audio Data Mine first, because it's chronological order, I suppose, and each builds. I mean, the other great thing about working with the Radio Centre is you get the opportunity to build on, the achievements of the previous projects, and there's a great kind of, learning process built into the way that the Radio Centre, works, particularly the way, Mark Barber, the planning director, along with Donna Burns, head of research, really do foster that way of working, which I think is a great benefit to the industry, and they should be applauded for it. But Big Audio Data Mine was Mark Barber's idea, and he came to me and he said, "Do you realise, Jason, that Radio Gauge, which I designed with Mark back in 2007, is now and continues to run. People very kindly call it the global currency for evaluating radio advertising." It's now, he said, evaluated over 1,000 radio campaigns since its inception, 17, 18 years ago. And what Mark wanted to do was to aggregate all of that data into a meta-analysis to see what we might learn when you take all of the outcomes from 1,000 different campaigns and see what's in there. So that's what we did. I mean, I've got to be honest, when I designed Radio Gauge back in the day, I had no idea it would carry on for this long or that we'd amass so much data. And what that meant was we never kind of intended to pull all of that data together into a format that would permit a meta-analysis. So the first big lesson was just doing that, bringing all those spreadsheets together was too difficult. It kind of gets in the way of learning more about radio. So from here on in, everything I do is built, from the very beginning with the ability to aggregate data from the start. So Big Audio Data Mine was, helping us think through those sorts of data management problems in the first instance. But then, we got to look very hard at the way the questionnaire it was working. I mean, the questionnaire has been working, certainly from our point of view, flawlessly as a template for all this time. But when you go into the real weeds on it and you're using regression analysis and stuff like that to figure out, are there duplications here? Are there modalities in the questionnaire structuring? You learn an awful lot about how to do ad effectiveness research in a slightly different way. And that's beginning to be reflected in some of the campaign effects innovations that we'll talk about in a bit. But yeah, Big Audio Data Mine gave us it's the world's biggest repository of advertising, audio advertising effectiveness, and learning about the importance of reach, but also I'd say creative consistency. That was something that really came through very, very loud. And then from that, we kind of did the performance multiplier. And the performance multiplier goes to the heart of that problem about attribution that I spoke about a few moments ago. We kind of hypothesized that radio was producing some kind of online response for advertisers. But we knew it was going to be difficult to measure because of the delayed response element, and that attribution methods wouldn't necessarily be picking up that response because it was necessarily delayed. We wanted to test that hypothesis. We wanted to understand, is there a delay? And if there is a delay, what are the implications of it from the point of view of measuring radio web response? And the findings were amazing. We did find a delay. And when we were using a self-tuning autoregression model that was using, technically alpha and beta parameters for delay and decay in an ad stock function transformation of independent variables for anyone who likes that kind of thing. What we discovered is that when you look at the average response profile to the average radio ad, only 25% of the response that any ad is going to produce occurs in the first hour after transmission. In fact, it can take from 12 to 19 hours for a single radio ad to generate all of the ad response it's going to. But probably more alarming in some respects is if you look at the first 20 minutes after ad transmission, that only accounts for 8% of the response that radio actually generates in the form of web visits. So for a long time after, coming from, from a bit of a background myself of like understanding how you generate visitors to your website so you can sell your product and talking to other CMOs with the same problem, people would say, yeah, we tried radio, but it's just like it did something, but we were getting better returns on investment from other channels. And so, excuse my French, the general message was maybe radio is just a bit shit. Actually, what we've discovered now, you were only measuring 8% of radio's response. It wasn't radio that was a bit shit. It was your measurement methodology. So that's one of those great moments when you actually can see definitively that, the opportunity costs for advertisers over all these years who've been measuring radio incorrectly, the opportunity cost to them has been, quite significant, but I would argue probably more so for radio networks. And, we've got now got a new theoretical foundation, which is very solid to help us, fix that problem now.
Now, as you mentioned, Radio Centre in the UK does a lot of groundbreaking research and is in one of the bigger radio markets. And I think what's going to be particularly of interest to delegates is that the approach you're going to be talking about in Venice is something that might arguably be more scalable for sort of medium and smaller radio markets who may have more limited budgets than the UK or the US, for example. That's something called Campaign FX that was carried out by you for Radio Centre Ireland. I mean, I don't want to preempt your paper too much because we want people to be in the room, but something of a teaser. What are you going to be talking about? How does that actually work?
Well, not wanting to preempt it too much, spoiler alerts, all that kind of thing. I think basically just outlining the business case, the imperative, the problem. And the problem, I kind of think, stems back to radio gauge in many respects, because in partnership with the Radio Centre, Colourtext has been operating radio gauge in other markets for a long time. I mean, it's operated for a time in South Africa. It's operated it for a short while in Australia, in Finland. I can't remember all the other places. Lots of Anglophone countries, as you'd expect. The issue is that those radio markets are often smaller than the UK, and therefore the cost of research relative to the cost of sale isn't sustainable. And being able to run radio gauge for as long as the Radio Centre has done, at the scale that Radio Centre does, isn't a long-term funding proposition that a lot of markets can sustain. So, Kieran Cunningham, who is the chief exec of Radio Centre Ireland, was very, very interested in having something like radio gauge in his market. But we both understood that the financial sustainability of it was going to be an issue. So They say that, necessity is the mother of invention, and I work with Kieran to figure out a way to do something that would give robust market response signals for audio advertisers at a financially sustainable on a financially sustainable basis. Can we build something that can do that? And the answer is yes, we did in the end. We did have to rethink an awful lot of our precepts or priors about how you do advertising evaluation research. So there's a lot of commonality between the way the survey works with Radio Gauge. However, there are some key fundamental differences, which I actually think make it very exciting. And there's an awful lot of potential in what we can do with the sort of data that Campaign FX can now generate at scale. So that's the background story.
So we'll be doing a deeper dive into that in Venice. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us today. And you can get tickets for the radio event on the ASA website. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. We'll also put a link to the Big Audio Datamine and Radio Performance Multiplier sections of the Radio Centre website. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us, Jason.
An absolute pleasure. Look forward to seeing you in Venice.